Next up on This Week in Law, we've got some very clueful gamers. Suzanne Jacque, Ryan Morrison, and Patrick Sweeney join me. I'm Denise Howell to discuss esports, FTC disclosures, Let's Play videos, and the complete obliteration of humanity, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson, episode 322, recorded October 2nd, 2015. Don't fear the avatar. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Hi, folks. We hope that you've got your consoles up and ready to go because we are ready to bring you another gaming law episode of This Week in Law. I'm so excited. I'm so interested in these issues. We really hope you are, too. We've got a great panel of folks to go over them with us here today, help you understand what's going on in the world of video game law. And we're going to do a lot on esports today, since that seems to be definitely the topic of the moment. Joining us today to go through these really fascinating issues is newly minted lawyer Suzanne Jacque. She's also known as Zed the Gamer. Are you officially changing all your handles to Zed the Lawyer now?
No, because gaming is so much more fun than law sometimes. It really depends on the day. But I mean, at the end of my day, I'm not pulling out contracts to read. I'm definitely breaking out Borderlands.
There we go. So Suzanne has just learned yesterday that she passed the Illinois bar. Yay! Huge congratulations.
So excited. It feels so good after 3 months of worrying and the previous 3 months of studying. And yes. Now we're here.
Woo! So yet another, well, you will be official in just a matter of a few days here, right, to practice law. 5th. Yes. Hey. Very exciting. So Suzanne, in addition to going to law school, taking the bar, passing the bar, she is she's just become the volunteer coordinator for Take This. Can you tell us about Take This?
Yeah. It's a volunteer position on my end, but what I'm going to be doing is handling the volunteer applications for Take This, which is It's takethis.org. It's a organization that deals with mental health issues in the gaming community. They do a lot of safe spaces at conventions so that if you're having anxiety or feeling overwhelmed or depressed, they have clinicians on site who are able to sit you down and work through those issues so that you can really get the most out of your experience when you're at community events.
Well, that's really cool. Good for you for doing that. Suzanne has also interned with one of our other guests today who we'll introduce in just a moment at the Interactive Entertainment Law Group. And anything else professionally official on the horizon, Suzanne, or are you still considering options?
Well, Patrick and I are currently discussing my future at the Interactive Entertainment Law Group, so we'll see where that goes, but I've got high hopes.
That's great. So Patrick Sweeney is also with us. He is the founder of the Interactive Entertainment Law Group and a founding member of the Video Game Bar Association. And among one of the few people in the world who really knows video game oriented transactions backwards and forwards. Great to have you back on the show, Patrick.
Thanks for having me, Denise.
Also joining us once again is Ryan Morrison, who, if you are a Redditor, you may know as Video Game Attorney there, does tons of great Q&As on Reddit about video game law. Great to see you again, Ryan.
Thanks for having me again. I'm very excited to do it.
Ryan's in New York and has his own firm called the Law Offices of Ryan P. Morrison, where he also practices video game law with a few other folks. So really wonderful to have all of you back with us today. To help. I'm not even in Conan O'Brien's league. I'm not even a clueless gamer because I don't really game at all. But I get to observe gamers in their natural habitat every single day of my life. So I feel like I sort of take it in by osmosis. And I do see the shifts that seem to happen and the things that seem to be a big deal as time goes on. And one thing that seems to be an extraordinarily big deal already and growing by leaps and bounds is the world of esports, which we're going to discuss under the rubric of legislation and policy because it's my suspicion, and we'll get our panel's take on this, that esports are sort of off in the wilderness right now as far as most regulation goes, but soon will be treated more like professional and collegiate sports are treated from a legal standpoint. Okay, so in preparing for this show today, we've got a lot of great articles on esports in our discussion points, which you too can check out if you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. That's where we've been aggregating all of our stories for the show lately. Wonderful statistics packing a lot of these stories. One of them, for example, that caught my eye is some of the money that's winnable in esports leagues. Professional golfer was pulled out for having won a PGA tournament and won $1.8 million. A Dota team who won their tournament won $18 million, 10 times as much as the professional golfer, to split among themselves. And the numbers of people viewing and participating in these leagues is really starting to go off the chart. Some people speculate that the number of folks who like to view either in person or live as it's happening, esports, exceeds the number of NHL fans here in the United States already and is closing in on the number of NFL fans. So with all that in mind, I'd like to just go around before asking specific questions about specific legal issues relating to esports and get our panel's feel for the state of the world of esports right now, starting with you, Ryan.
Sure. So esports is something that's growing incredibly quickly. There's a lot of outside money coming in. There's a lot of people who are in the entertainment industry, but not the game industry, starting to see all those sums of money you were talking about and saying, hey, I want a cut of that. In exchange, it's now getting more airtime on places like ESPN, who's, you know, dipping their toe in the water. They aired some of the Dota series. They had a short bit explaining what esports are, which, and just for people who are not aware, esports are quite literally people playing video games at a very competitive and professional level in a tournament style for a lot of money. So it's not games like Mario, like you might be familiar with, but it's more the ones that are really picking up steam are a lot of first-person shooters and a lot of really team-based games that require an incredible amount of coordination, constant thinking, and reflexes that just most humans don't have, myself included. I'm lucky enough to work with a lot of the players, and you know, every once in a while they'll jokingly let me play with them, and it's embarrassing. It's you know, like trying to play football with Peyton Manning as the other quarterback. you know, everyone under the age of 15, as strange as it sounds, I truly believe is going to know their favorite esports athlete over their favorite baseball player. Those kind of, you know, baseball is very slow. It doesn't have the attention of the youth anymore at all, unless maybe they play it. I grew up watching baseball and I'm very excited. The Mets are looking legitimate for the first time in my life. And that said, you know, it's much more exciting to sit in Madison Square Garden and watch people play this game on the screen, and I know that's ridiculous, and I would have laughed at myself if I said that a year ago, but I went to the arena, the crowd is really into it, and you have to kind of almost forget that those are humans playing on a computer in the middle of the floor, because what's really happening is on the screen there, and they're controlling it, and they're kind of, it's almost if they put on a suit of armor and played football in it, you know how a lot of sci-fi movies would have thought sports were evolving to. I think this is a lot closer to where they're going, and it's not slowing down. It's only picking up steam. The gambling communities are so strongly behind it, and there's just endless money going into it.
Yeah, that's certainly been what I've been reading and hearing about from all kinds of fronts. Patrick, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, the ironic thing is that this isn't really that new. About 10 or 12 years ago, Blizzard was doing tournaments in Korea pretty regularly, and professional video game athlete, video game players in Korea have been celebrities for at least a decade. So it's really catching fire here now, and I think you can see a lot of that coming from a lot of the things that are coming out of that are investment opportunities and new entrants into the space. Advertisers are taking a long, hard look at it. Advertising agencies are looking at this as a valuable outlet for their clients now. So you're seeing a lot of attention being paid to this.
And Suzanne, what do you think about just sort of the overall world of esports and what's happening to it?
I think it's actually in a really interesting space right now because it's gaining all of this legitimacy with ESPN and these millions of dollars in prizes. But at the same time, we're dealing with all of these regulatory issues that no one initially considered because it was just a bunch of guys playing games. Like, initially, I think not even a lot of the athletes considered this a sport as much as we do now.
Right. Are any of you going to the Major League Gaming Finals, World Finals, that are coming up later this month in New Orleans?
So that's an interesting question also. You know, esports is not one thing. So there's probably about 8 games that are worth anything right now in terms of professional esports. So I've gone to the finals for the esports I represent clients in. This one I won't be attending, but it's hard to make everything. It really is growing so quickly where there's some kind of championship with some kind of league almost every month somewhere in the country. So it's hard to go to them all.
Right. Is Major League, who do you think are the big players, the big leagues that people are playing for at this point?
That's the interesting point, and I might be disagreed with on that, but the mm-hmm. The major difference between these games and something like the NFL is there really are no leagues here. There is mm-hmm. MLG, there is ESL, there is LCS. Those are all kind of, they're growing, and some of them are certainly very legitimate. They have a lot of money behind them. They have a lot of organization. But it's not like MLG is the only league in that game. So the teams are kind of bouncing all over the place, playing mm-hmm. a lot of different leagues, winning a lot of different money. And, until there's more structure with this is the league people are playing in this game, it's going to be hard to see who's kind of really standing out. But certainly MLG and ESL are the top two dogs probably in what I'm seeing.
Are there variations between organizations like MLG and ESL as far as the way things are structured, rules that players have to follow, or is there some uniformity in that starting to take shape?
There's certainly industry standards taking place in the sense that they can't change what the actual game is, but they're changing the structure of the tournaments, and ESL just famously started drug testing because Adderall abuse and other kind of focused drugs were being heavily abused in esports, as they are in basically all sports. But it's, the differences are in the structure side of things and only minimal. The actual games are the games, and it's just kind of a race to see who's going to get the biggest players most consistently at their sports. But something like Dota, they have these ESL tournaments, they have these MLG tournaments, but Dota, the big one, the international that is kind of their world series, the one you said with the $1 million prize pool, that's actually owned by the company who makes the game. So it's not in any of those leagues, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. So, we'll see how that all kind of evolves. But right now it's anybody's guess which one's going to kind of stand out long term.
Right. What do you think about gender and esports? I guess this would be a way that esports are different than other professional sports that we're familiar with, at least in the U.S., where teams tend to break down on gender lines because of different abilities of the players. Patrick, that doesn't seem to happen in esports, does it?
Well, theoretically, it shouldn't, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think anybody cares who's better at playing League of Legends, whether it's a male or a female. As long as they can play and win the money, they're going to have a spot on the team, so to speak. But You know, obviously the game demographics tend to fall a certain ways, and you know, but it doesn't necessarily mean there won't be people outside of that demographic playing no matter what. So,
yes, let's hear from our demographic buster on that. What do you think, Suzanne?
I think it's hard for women in esports. There's been a lot of harassment going around, of course, because there's always harassment. There's always trash talking. It's just what happens, and it's taken differently from different perspectives. As far as skill, I don't see there's a difference, but the arguments will be made that, hey, women's hands are smaller. They will be able to handle the controllers the same, and they shouldn't be playing on men's leagues. I don't think it's valid, and I don't think that anyone should validate it by separating the leagues. And I think it's actually a really interesting opportunity to integrate women as equals into a sport, particularly for universities and professional leagues, where we can start setting that example from a really high level.
Just right. To play devil's advocate and make everyone hate me, Street Fighter, I believe it was Street Fighter, tried to integrate their female league and their male league, and the females actually started complaining because they were winning less prize money, they weren't placing nearly as high, and the three women that were kind of dominating the female Street Fighter league were stopped making money entirely once they went to the male league, because the male players just in this situation happened to be placing better and were doing more consistently placing in the top three and earning the money. So there was a little kickback there. In terms of the more team sports, there isn't a line. So if a woman wants to play on a Dota team, she's absolutely welcome to. But as Patrick said, you know, the demographics just unfortunately aren't there. There's not a lot of female professional gamers. There is certainly some. There's a team of all women that competes. But the ones that come in, they're certainly harassed by the internet, which is an unfortunate, just terrible reality that exists on the internet. Hopefully that's subsiding, but it's you know, there's more and more every year. And I hope to, of course, see more. But the answer of should we have the separate leagues or should everything be integrated isn't always as simple as everyone, you know, wants just the kind of nicest answer there.
Right. So your point in bringing up the women who started making less money is they actually wanted it the other way. They wanted to go back to a segregated league where they could make more money. I could see that being a driver. What about Title IX at the collegiate level? When we've had you guys on the show before, we were talking about colleges offering scholarships for their esports teams. Do you think Title IX would apply in that situation? Let's start with you, Patrick.
That's a really good question. I think that's something that we're going to have to deal with, I think, as this evolves. I mean, some schools are starting to offer the scholarships now for esports players, and I just don't think that's been considered yet. So that I don't know how that's going to fall out. That's going to be fun to watch, actually.
Yeah, it will be interesting. And sort of what the NCAA does with esports as well. Any guesses?
Well, there needs to be some governing body, I think, for if you're going to have collegiate level esports tournaments. There's going to need to be some basic rules, like Ryan was saying, right? Whether you know, just like they have on the professional level with ESL or MLG. But you know, that I think they're far behind those organizations now. So I don't know what they're going to do at the collegiate level. I don't think they've thought it through yet.
Right. Ryan, you mentioned drug testing. That's a fairly recent thing, isn't it?
Yes, only a couple months.
Uh-huh. And ESL is doing it. Is anybody else?
There are other leagues that are definitely starting to implement it or talk about implementing it. It's it's a real issue across the board because, and there's no simple answer. I won't pretend to have it. Basically, what's happening is every single player is not, of course, not every single player. I'm a lawyer, so I shouldn't be speaking in absolutes. But there, it's no secret that most of them are abusing these drugs. They joke about it on their Twitters. They are very open about it, and they're open that everyone else is doing it too. So it's a real problem, and very few of them have a legitimate prescription. Now ESL said, or I'm actually not even sure where ESL wound up signing on everything, but basically what was proposed was if you have a prescription, you can still use it. That just means everyone who wants it is going to go get a prescription because the easiest thing to do in America is get an Adderall prescription. Anyone can do it with a 5-minute doctor visit. You can see on Yelp reviews of doctors who will hand out the prescription easier than others. So the only solution I've seen that or the only solution I can come up with that I think would be kind of the safe answer here is to have a league mandated doctor who is the one giving out these, yes, you are diagnosed, you are not diagnosed. Otherwise, it's just, it's unfair to the people who truly need it if you just ban it flat out, and it's unfair to the people who are, and it's not a solution to just let everybody use it. So there has to be some kind of serious step taken there, because a majority of these players are kids, and it's terrible to incentivize them to abuse any sort of drugs to win money illegally. So, you know, this is a controlled to substance, Adderall. It's up there with cocaine. So it's not something that should be given out the way it is. And you know, all politics aside on that, it's just something that is definitely being abused in the industry. And it's a terrible, you know, dark shadow over the industry if we keep ignoring it.
Well, and it's probably complicated, and this would be just a guess and an assumption on my part, not backed up by any data at all, but given the demographics of people who might be drawn to professional gaming, you might have an unusually high percentage of folks who have ADD, ADHD, other conditions that Adderall is actually prescribed for. So you might have a high number of people who are just prone to be on the drug, perhaps have been on the drug for a while, in addition to the ones who would like to start taking it to enhance their gaming skills. So it seems like it would be really tough to determine who's taking it for what reasons. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely have a skewed view on this because I worked with the New York Times for a while, specifically just on Adderall abuse stories. So I've seen it ruin a lot of lives. I've seen it be completely beneficial to people's lives. It truly is a miracle drug in a sense, where we don't have enough long-term studies on it. But as with anything, it's usually not good to be abusing something that changes your personality and your mind without it being properly looked at by a doctor. So, you know, the answer here is yes. I'm sure there's plenty of professional players that truly need it. At the same time, you can't just use that as an excuse to let everyone use it. It needs to be really better regulated and really looked at from a very serious standpoint. And I'm very happy ESL did it. I think that was incredibly brave of them to be the first ones to kind of start it. So kudos to them.
Right.
I think it's funny to, or interesting to watch how all of these issues are paralleling, a lot of the traditional sports, and, you know, drug testing is traditionally handled in a collective bargaining agreement with a players union. So, my first thought when I saw that was that the opening the door to drug testing is going to facilitate or make unionization of some of the players come even faster. So that's something to watch out for.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely a necessary step here that we've completely stepped over. Peyton Manning doesn't negotiate his own contracts. He doesn't decide what the league's allowed to do. The players have a union, and the players collectively bargain against the league for, here's what we're going to allow, here's how an appeal process is going to work, et cetera, et cetera. Here we don't even have a league to bargain with, and we don't have players that are unified by any means. They have no representation. There are, of course, some attorneys and some agents, but very few. And most of the players have been told by their team owners, I don't even want to say most anymore, because the more and more involved I get, I see there are truly some good team owners. But there's also a number of team owners who quite literally say, if you have an attorney look at your contract, you're off the team. So that kind of bullying still very much exists in esports. And until there's a union watching out for that player, it's not going to be fixed.
Wow, that's really tough to take. And it looks like, I'm sure that will be, at least I have fond hopes that will be a temporary situation. And as more and more money and talent go into these teams, that team owners won't be able to say that anymore, that, they simply won't be able to get the players that they need, because people will be savvy enough to know that you have to read your contracts and even better negotiate them and make sure they make sense. But do you guys think that a players' union is on the horizon?
You want to start one today, Patrick?
Sure, why not? I think it's inevitable. I think it's just a matter of time. I don't know how much time that's going to be. It's not going to be in 6 months or anything like that. But I think there is going to be some level of standardization and collective bargaining that's going to happen at this level for esports.
And just what I've noticed before a union, kind of, we're very lucky in games and esports because the lawyers in it, as of now, you know, Patrick, myself, and the other handful of lawyers that work in this, they actually care about esports. They want to see it grow. They are gamers themselves. They like the players. We all get along at a personal level. So when we're doing these contracts for the players and even on the other side for the team, somebody like Bryce Bloom, who represents a lot of the teams, you know, we're all not making contracts that are one-sided and robbing the other side. That's occurring when you get a team owner getting a contract off Google or something like that. But as Patrick said, the kind of industry standard line is being created by the lawyers in this industry because there is no regulation, there is no league. And what's more, it would be impossible to have a players union of esports players. You would need a players union for each individual game, which is mind-numbingly difficult when you start to really break it down. You know, but the people playing Dota have completely separate interests than the people playing Call of Duty. And it's, you know, it would be like the NHL collective bargaining with the NFL. It's just not something that's viable. So it, you know, we have to really work on figuring out where the lines are before we can hop to the next level, I think. I don't know.
I agree with a lot of that, Ryan, but I think there's certain things that are going to be universal among any game that you're playing, whether it's the drug testing side of it, you know, or whatnot. So I think you could probably start by getting some standardization at a higher level, right? At a 10,000 foot level, that's sort of not dependent on what game you're playing. But I think there are going to be, I don't know if it's subsections or riders, if you will, based on what game you're playing, that they're going to get more granular. But it'll start, I think, at the higher level.
That's it. Do you think the colleges put it? And I'm sorry to be asking questions and not my interview, but do you think it starts more at the college level with them? Because, you know, esports are getting very popular at a college level, and my headphones keep popping out. I'm sorry. It's getting very popular at a college level. So do you think the colleges are the ones that kind of start these lines of what's okay and what's not okay before there's a union? Or do you think the union kind of appears first?
I don't, being a longtime college sports fan, I don't have a lot of confidence in the NCAA. So I don't see them trailblazing in any capacity. I think that'll probably come when we get to effectively who's the winner out of the professional promoters and whether that's, you know, MLG or whatnot. I think when we have sort of that clear cut leader on the professional level, they'll probably start driving that process. So I just don't see the NCAA. I don't see this being anything near their forefront.
Yeah, agreed. Just curious.
They should be in a perfect world, but I.
Oh, of course, yeah. But I'm with you on how they usually handle matters.
Yeah.
Ryan, can you drill down for a second on something you mentioned a minute ago, that the interests of a League of Legends player might not be the same as a Dota player and might, in fact, be completely different? Why is that?
Sure. So the first and foremost, a lot of these games are team games and a lot are single player games. So when you start looking at something, do all players on the team have to be offered travel if the team's offering travel, or do all players on the team have to be offered the same kind of benefits? Is there a low level pay for the fifth person on a five person team? Is there, you know, in the NFL, for example, the minimum required pay for a quarterback is different than the minimum required pay for a linebacker. So that means that the single person playing Call of Duty is going to be bargaining for himself and his interests as they align with the rest of the league. In a team sport or a team game, it's going to be more bargaining by the better players for the rest of the league, with them kind of forgotten. So that's where the co-aligning can exist, as Patrick said. And probably now that, you know, it's nothing exists yet. So, you know, Patrick almost convinced me entirely with that short sentence that it probably will occur across the board first at a higher level with the top players in the team sports and the top players in the single sports, because their interests will be pretty similar. But even things, this is video games, it's not football. So even things such as when can a game update a patch, when a patch comes out and includes a new player, how long until that player can be included in the game professionally for these tournaments, because the players need time to learn the player, learn how to combat against the player. It would be as if the NFL put spikes on the football and said, all right, you know, tomorrow's the Super Bowl, now there's spikes on the football, go have fun. And that's something that would only matter to the Dota player. But in Call of Duty, they're not adding characters, they're not adding things like that. So it would be something completely out of their interest and out of their bargaining chips that they would happily cave on. So that's where the kind of what everybody's concerns are don't necessarily align. But at a very top level, as Patrick said, with drug testing and with base pay and just being taken care of and being certain that you're allowed to talk to an attorney, that kind of stuff is something that exists across all the sports. So that's probably where it will start.
Wow, I think you just gave the advertising industry something they're going to lobby for with the next Super Bowl. Spikes on the football. It would certainly drive up ratings. Let's make that our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in the show in case you are listening for legal or other professional credit, legal education credit in various jurisdictions. You are more than welcome, and we encourage you to apply for credit. For listening to the show. We certainly are discussing some cutting edge and interesting issues here with some very knowledgeable people on them. If you need more information about how you might do that, go to wiki.twit.tv, find our show page there, This Week in Law, and we'll put another of these phrases in the show later on so that you can show your oversight body if you need to that you watched or listened to the show. We're here with three great guests, Suzanne Jacque, Ryan Morrison, and Patrick Sweeney today, discussing some of the differences and some of the similarities between esports and conventional sports. One of the differences, Suzanne, or maybe it is a similarity that will find itself playing out in a similar way or a different way in the world of esports, I'm not sure yet. Let me get your opinion, is the fact that young people can be very, very good at the games that are played professionally. And I'm sure that's true of baseball and football and basketball and hockey as well. But my impression of what seems to happen there is if you are a talented under 18-year-old, you're probably going to be drafted by a college and go through the college system before you begin playing professionally. Do you think that we'll see a parallel like that with esports, or are we going to see younger people playing against older professionals?
This is a really difficult question because I'm split on it. On the one hand, I mm-hmm. want people to go through the proper steps and achieve maturity in healthy ways and be exposed to things at the right times and not achieve millions of dollars in wealth that they don't know what to do with and just want to spend on frivolously and not save. And the contractual issues are a whole other thing because minors are difficult to contract with because mm-hmm. you have to contract through their agents and everything else. But on the other hand, if there's a 14-year-old out there who's really skilled at this and could make a killing at it and has the kind of parents who would be willing to help them maintain balance and have good savings and has a good lawyer and is able to prepare themselves for a really good future, that would be excellent. And I totally support that. So someplace in the middle of that?
Right. All right. What do our guys who negotiate contracts and draft them for players think about the status of younger players in esports? Ryan?
I mean, the reality of it is most younger players aren't associated with schools. They drop out to play these games, and there's a lot of money to be made. So it's the same as a basketball player only going to his freshman year. So mm-hmm. the in Dota, for example, there's a 27-year-old who just won the international and all those millions of dollars. He's 27 years old, and they call him Old Man. Yeah, that's his nickname. So, in what you're asking about is it's not really anyone, quote-unquote, old playing these games. So the kids are still the main – I would say the average player's age is about 23. That's professional. There's certainly 16-year-olds that play. I think one of the other members of that team was 16 years old, Sumail from Iraq, I believe. He is 16 or 17, and he's now very rich. He will not be going to college, I would assume. On the other hand, there's a player named Zai, or that's his gamer name. He was the favorite to win all these millions of dollars. He did not. He won a pittance of that, and he went back to college. So it's the college scene of esports is very limited, and the reality of the kids playing with the adults is more completely removed from school and something that's just going to exist forever. If you have a 16-year-old who's better than all your 25-year-olds, you're going to sign that 16-year-old. It certainly brings complexities to the contracts and the negotiation process, but that's why we charge hourly.
There you go. Patrick, what's your take on the age of professional players as we sit here today and going forward?
Well, obviously, you have to be the age to be able to enter into a contract. So there is that complexity, which I think Ryan was referencing as well. But for something like this, talent is what's going to drive it. If a 16-year-old is the best one out there, then he or she's going to make the most money. Again, if you look at the professional sports leagues, they have collectively bargained somebody's got to be a certain age before they can declare for the draft or anything like that. But these esports isn't there, so it's an open playing field.
Right. Is it your impression now that most players are over 18 or not?
Oh, I don't know the demographics. I mean, I got to figure that they're somewhere between 16 and 23, and that is the lion's share of them. So, you put that in the you put a median in there. I'm sure there's a lot of them that are under 18, and that's and that's fine. I mean, I don't have a philosophical problem with that. As long as, there's not the, 16-year-olds that are being forced to practice 22 hours a day, which is, again, where it comes back to, comes back to some sort of standardization from a union perspective.
Which does happen, which is a real concern.
I'm sure
concern.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is a true concern, where the 16-year-old, that 16-year-old might be incredible, so he gets signed to a contract with an owner who's bullying him into playing this game 18 hours a day, living in the house, and never leaving. I mean, there's stories you can Google about some of these teams where they have a team house, they all practice and live together. They're not allowed friends over, they're not allowed girlfriends over, and they just have to play this sport in the hopes that they'll win the millions of dollars and their owner will get a cut. So that's definitely, as Patrick said, something that's going to need to be watched out for and fixed, because it's terrible. But
that happens probably... I think the younger somebody is, maybe the less sophisticated they are as far as, being able to stand up for themselves or bargain for themselves. So I think that you have to watch out for the younger player a little bit more in those scenarios than you do a 27-year-old who could theoretically say, to hell with this and stand up and walk away. It's a concern no matter what your age. I just think it probably is going to affect the younger players a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing for young people and their parents to think about is they, I know a few kids who are thinking professional gaming, that just has got to be my thing. And they certainly need to know that this kind of not ideal situation is possible on your path to glory in that profession.
But it's the same as wanting to be a rock star and playing open mic nights every night. It's kids are always going to want to be something that they idealize and watch. So you're not going to talk him out of wanting to be a professional gamer if that's what he wants. Just like, my parents couldn't talk me out of thinking that my band was going to blow up. Turns out my band didn't blow up.
That's funny. Susanna, any thoughts on I know you chimed in earlier on younger players, but anything else you want to add to this?
No, I just think that we really do need to consider the age and simplicity of certain players. I mean, they're very... Mm-hmm. good at gaming and they are on an adult level, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily adults, and treating them like adults and training them like adults and putting them up against adults puts them in this really weird psychological space that isn't necessarily healthy.
Right. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about at the top of the show when I introduced you, Take This. It's sort of eye-opening to me that there's an organization that helps gamers with mental health issues. Is it a big problem in the industry?
Gaming's this really interesting space because most of us are escapists, to steal a word from a popular site. Gaming is how you get away from it. Instead of a movie or a book, you're playing a game. You're a different character. You're in a different world. And you can explore a lot of really honest things through those characters. But when you're back in the real world, you don't have those pre-scripted dialogues to deal with issues like depression, anxiety, and other things that are really core to the human experience but have been in the back corner for so long for so many cultures.
Okay, we're going to take a break for a moment here before we come back in and discuss fantasy esports and some new developments in that area. We're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or you run a small business, chances are that your least favorite part of it, just like me in my law practice, is rummaging through receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, formatting, and sending invoices, and the worst, tracking down customers who don't pay you on time. FreshBooks is absolutely your savior in this regard. It's the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours and mine the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. And actually, without FreshBooks, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. You know, I would have to hire staff to take up the slack that FreshBooks takes care of for me. It couldn't be easier to get started, even if you're not a numbers person at all. You don't have to be. That's the whole point of FreshBooks. You'll be creating and sending invoices in minutes. It does all the math for you. That's an important point to mention. It is, you know, the invoices that you send out are spreadsheets. All you do is you plug in your time, the increments of time that you're spending doing work for clients. And it takes it from there. And that's just the beginning of what FreshBooks does. It also captures your expenses, whether you're in your office or on the go. It has a mobile app that helps you track both time and expenses wherever you are and instantly. With their automated late payment reminders, you can avoid those awkward emails and phone calls to late paying clients and just, you know, give them that nice little reminder that winds up getting you paid. You wonder why you didn't start sooner. If you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. Getting started is simple and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of my law practice and of this show that we enjoy doing each and every week, This Week in Law. All right, getting back to the world of esports, gaming and gambling often get confused. One is the playing of the games. The other is the betting on them. But that world is getting a bit more blurred. Sports betting is technically illegal in the United States, but not in the fantasy context where the skill element outweighs the element of chance. And fantasy esports are a thing. FanDuel and DraftKings are recognizing that. These people who are pumping ads at you all the time to come join their fantasy sports leagues. FanDuel just acquired AlphaDraft. There's another esports platform for fantasy esports out there called Vulcan. Patrick, what do you think about this aspect of esports?
Just from the consolidation standpoint. So from the corporate side of them buying it, whereas another competitor, DraftKings, is building the fantasy component to their platform internally. So I look at it from a deal perspective, and it's just this massive race to be the winner in this space between FanDuel and DraftKings. You know, they've each raised a ton of money and they're putting it in play. So I look at it from that angle, and I find that really interesting.
Ryan, is this just another sign that the world of esports is, although it's still immature, comparatively speaking, that it is maturing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sign that the rest of the entertainment industry is taking this seriously and realizing how much money's in this. Fantasy in esports is certainly not evolved to the point where it is with baseball or football. The actual point systems don't make a lot of sense in a lot of games, and et cetera, et cetera. But all these websites are starting their branch of esports gambling. It's exploding. It's becoming very popular. And there's a lot of competing companies that are, exactly as Patrick said, just in a race to be the one that does it. With regards to why it's legal and poker's not, for example, is exactly as you said, where in America we have some kind of arbitrary line where if something is skill-based, you can bet money on it in a tournament-like setting. And if it's pure luck, you can't gamble on it. Now, why is poker pure luck and fantasy sports is skill? I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that, you know, there is a skill element to both, but there's also just luck to both. Who gets that touchdown pass in football determines who wins your fantasy football league. And you can have the best receiver on the team, but that doesn't mean he's the one getting the ball. So it's the line's a bit arbitrary. It's certainly going to be tested now that there is all this money in it and now that there is all these eyes on it. I do think it's going to win. I think fantasy sports are not going to be deemed illegal or anything like that. But it's going to be, I think, regulated first above anything else we talked about.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very arbitrary thing. I've played poker against people who've cleaned my clock, and they definitely were using skill as opposed to luck. Susanna, any thoughts about gambling and gaming?
I think the rise of fantasy sports and esports says a lot of interesting things about the fans. Like Ryan said earlier, a lot of younger folks know more about their favorite players than they or game player, esports players, than they do mm-hmm. about their favorite sports or athletes on the football or basketball teams. So the fact that these companies are investing in that future generation of spenders is really interesting from a business perspective.
Well, that's a great segue in that it gives us another way to talk about how esports are different in a way from other professional sports that we know about. And that is the whole social media and personality aspect of it. It seems like many, if not most, of the esports players out there are not just athletes playing their game, but they're also rock stars in a sense. They're rock stars in the video world that they do and narrate Let's Play videos, that they have a whole persona that they've developed side by side alongside their acumen at playing video games, and that they're oftentimes practicing and developing their skills in public as they are filming themselves and broadcasting their own gameplay and commentary. Suzanne, do you agree with me on that assessment?
Yeah, totally. I think that esports players are a lot more accessible than professional athletes, just in that they are posting Let's Plays and they are tweeting, and you can tweet at them and they'll respond, and they're on the games, you know their handles, you know their tags, and it almost, you develop a relationship with that person. They aren't just someone who's on your TV on Sundays. There's someone mm-hmm. who's on your Twitter, on your Facebook, you're watching their Let's Play on YouTube or Twitch. Your life is just kind of rolling along with theirs.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is another way in which esports athletes might be at a disadvantage, especially if they are young, in that they don't necessarily realize all the rules that apply to them, not only as they're playing their sport, but as they are talking about and narrating their own and others' play of the sport. There have been a couple of instances lately where it's been clear that the FTC at least thinks, you know, we've talked a lot on this show about the FTC guidelines that went into place for disclosing when you are endorsing something, if you are being paid or otherwise compensated for that endorsement. And we tend to think about that in the context of blogs and social media and Twitter. But in the gaming world, it comes up as people are affiliated either with a league or a game developer, et cetera, and are doing very positive things in connection with that partner and not disclosing. Suzanne, you did a piece on this recently.
Yeah, there's really interesting spaces, especially with like peripherals. Currently wearing Razer headphones. Razer sponsors some of the teams. So they'll be mm-hmm. using the peripherals on their stream and not mention that, hey, I got all of these peripherals for free, but Razer is obviously getting free advertising out of it. And the FTC definitely frowns on not disclosing that kind of advertising.
Mm-hmm. Is this something you think the players' union might be able to help out with, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's something they're going to have to deal with as far as disclosures, and certainly as far as splitting the revenue share, right? If if a team owner cuts a deal with Razer, you can be sure that any collective bargaining is going to address how that money is allocated among the team members, because right now maybe it isn't being allocated at all. So, it's the disclosures and the revenue share will be part of it.
Right. One specific instance where this happened had to do with Dead Realm. Have you been paying attention to this, Ryan?
Dead Realm? Not in particular. Can you just give me a quick summary on that one?
Yeah, it's a game. It's a horror game that's been very successful on Steam. And some of its YouTubers neglected to mention that they had financial ties to the game itself. The game developers called Three Black Dot.
Right. I knew about that as the Three Black Dot. Yeah, and that's exactly right. What it is. And they got caught, but it's a lot of people do this. A lot of companies do this. There's so many successful and popular and well-watched YouTubers who are such a fine line between what's entertainment and what's a true review that people are relying on. And that's when the payola argument comes in, where, you know, do these people need to be disclosing things? How do you comply with these new FTC regulations? It's a fine line across the board. So it's certainly something everyone's been abusing, though, because there was no rules. So a lot of these reviewers were making a lot of money playing games. Dark Realm happened to be one of the ones that got a bunch of bad headlines about it, but they're certainly not alone.
Patrick, one of the pieces in our discussion points today, one of the lawyers interviewed about doing video game law made sort of an off-the-cuff comment that he thought it was time for players to kind of grow up and stop airing all their dirty laundry on social media, that's going to be something that has to happen in the industry if it's going to develop and advance. Do you agree with that, or are we looking at something different here where things in this industry may just happen to unfold in a more transparent way, given this sort of dual nature of the athletes, that they are both online personalities and athletes?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that goes back to the earlier comment that a lot of this is, a lot of these folks are younger. They may not have a certain, you know, level of maturity or world experience that they can draw on some of this stuff. And sometimes they're going to say something stupid. It's going to bite them, right? I mean, that happens with football players, right? Is it Johnny Manziel? Famously tweeted out that he was at a pool in Las Vegas hanging out with a bunch of people, and there was a bunch of beer cans around him when he was supposed to be in mini camp, right? Those things are going to happen. And it'll change as people see the consequences of that, right? If somebody is airing their dirty laundry, and maybe they're not going to get an endorsement from Razer or from Monster Energy Drink or something like that, because they're not as stable, of an investment, and that will help people grow up. And I think as some of these esports athletes are being surrounded by better people on the decision-making side from a business perspective, whether that's agents or managers or lawyers or whomever, they'll get some of that guidance and they'll learn that maturity over time. But right now, I'm sure it's all across the board. There are some smart people and there are some dumb people out there.
Right.
I mean, we live in such a different time with that now. What famously just happened is that the team, and famously within esports, I should put the little asterisk on there. the team that won the international in Dota, they kicked off one of their best players immediately after to make room for another guy for completely personal reasons. They were shuffling things around. Whatever the reasons were, he was kicked off. He had just won the tournament, and Twitter exploded that there was no explanation within an hour. The explanation came maybe 6 hours later, and that just wasn't quick enough because we live in a very different world now. And it's across the board. We can pretend it's esports and video games alone, but even this show, we have a live chat going on during this. You film the kind of beginning part where it's almost the making of. And we live in a very, I want to see everything, I want to see it now society. And these kids are growing up in that a lot more than we did. So they're tweeting everything nonstop about their practices. They're saying, come watch my Let's Play video, come watch my live stream on Twitch while I do practice. And all of a sudden something goes terrible and they go right back to Twitter and talk about it. So there is no filter, and that's for good and for bad while they're kind of growing as a celebrity. But you'll see it with young singers, you'll see it with young actors, you'll see it, as Patrick said, with a lot of players in the NFL who are coming in. It's not an esports problem, it's a youth problem, those damn kids, it's something that just is very different than what we're used to, but also a reality that's not going away.
Right. Well, it might be less a problem and more a solution for one of the things that we talked about today, which is a one-sided contract kind of issue. And of course, it could be a problem if they're not allowed to disclose the terms of their contracts. But assuming that they could, one of the ways that Twitter explosions can be very helpful is if there is some draconian contract provision that someone has not just put in their one-on-one, you know, this is my individual contract with this other organization, but terms of service and things, we see that all the time where some diligent person spots the term in there that no one really thinks they can live with, and then Facebook or whoever else it might be realizes, whoops, we misstepped there and we better change that. Suzanne, do you think that it could be helpful for players to have the internet on their side and looking at some of the stuff that might not be so advantageous for them?
I feel like for the most part, contracts are hidden under so many layers of non-disclosure agreements and confidentiality agreements that mm-hmm. we're never actually going to see a contract unless it's from a client. So I think discussing theoretical situations on Twitter that might be happening, or bad things that have happened in the past, or contracts that have come out through litigation, super interesting, and it's super good to get that out there to the folks that are going to be signing these contracts in the future and make them aware that, hey, some contracts have these nasty little clauses like this one. Maybe you should get a lawyer to read it before signing it. But I don't think actually getting the contracts onto Twitter will ever happen, because there are too many good lawyers out there who are covering them in non-disclosure agreements.
Do you agree, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's plenty of ways that people will sort of get the word out that, you know, so-and-so is really difficult to deal with or whatever, even without violating the confidentiality. I mean, that happens in our business, right? Sitting around at the Game Developers Conference, people will always say, oh, I can't believe dealing with insert company. Their terms are so awful. You know, I can't really talk about it, but you know, they're awful with this, right? And or you know, even going into their valuation or what their strategy is. There was actually litigation about that recently because somebody at a party mouthed off to somebody else and said, I happen to know what your market cap is and what your valuation is going to be. And you know, once you try to go public and blah, blah, blah. And they sued them because they didn't think they should have that information. We all have that information inside the industry, and we use it how we can, right? I mean, that's part of the value of having that information. So I think there's a value of whether it's Twitter or whatnot, you know, of being able to say, hey, look, this isn't fair, and standing up for yourself. But obviously the people are going to try to put that under wraps relative to confidentiality and whatnot. But it's still going to happen. It's just whether it's going to happen that loudly or not.
Okay, we're going to shift gears in a moment here from talking about the world of players and teams in esports to the world of observing video games and esports in just a bit. But before we leave the actual play issues, my 11-year-old focus group that I consulted in getting ready for the show today tossed out a couple of legal issues, or what they considered legal issues that we should talk about. And one of them had to do with modded controllers. You guys have already talked about peripherals and what a big part of the industry that is, whether it's headsets or controllers or mics or video capture equipment, everything else that goes into making video gaming and esports what they are today. It seems to, the one controller that they mentioned to me is a SCUF controller, SCUF, which seemed to be this perfectly legitimate business that has partnerships with esports leagues and teams, and forthrightly says this will make you a better gamer if you use our controller. And I guess there are a couple of layers to that, if I understand it correctly, that first of all, there's the controller itself and the way it functions differently from the stock controllers that you get. And then there's the way it can be customized to give you abilities that you might not otherwise have in the game. What do you guys think about modded controllers? And is this the esports parallel to Deflategate, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a fair parallel to a degree where, so the way esports tournaments are usually set up, and at least in my experience, I haven't worked on them all, of course, is you have to use the exact same computer, you have to use the exact same monitor as everyone else. The keyboard and mouse are sometimes allowed to be brought in by the player themselves, as long as they're within certain regulations. Those regulations being you can't have those auto keys and things like that, you are allowed to have macro keys in a lot of situations. And a lot of professional players on a game where I use 2 buttons on a mouse, they're using 15 buttons on a mouse. And that's just because they're much better. They can figure all that stuff out, and they map it how they will. But they're not going to be able to sit there before a tournament and map out all their macros and hotkeys for an hour before the game starts. So, you know, as much as those controllers allow you to do things that are very complicated and potentially very game-altering, it's not seen in tournaments, at least in my experience. Now, if it has something where when you hold down A, it spams A as fast as it can for you, that's something different. That's a, you know, a turbo button or something like that. That would be not allowed and certainly akin to cheating within most tournament rules that I've seen. So, you know, the lines are there already. It's very hard to bring in hardware that's going to be in any way assisting you cheating. And also, those kind of controllers are for console games, and those things are dead anyway.
Those things are dead. You heard it here, folks. Suzanne, what do you think about modded controllers, both in the professional esports world and also just for the casual gamer? You know, I guess there are consequences to using one of these things in that you're going to tick off your fellow gamers and possibly get booted from the server or the game, right?
I honestly view it on par with Nikes or Adidas or whoever else you buy for your running shoes. Every pair of running shoes I pass says this pair of shoes is going to make me run faster or improve my stride or whatever else the shoe is supposed to do. But they're all shoes and they all function more or less the same. They may have different padding or different things, but as long as they're all functioning basically as shoes and they don't have springs or rollerblades in them hidden somewhere, I don't think it's a huge game-breaking deal. It's the same kind of peripherals we see in every other sport.
Okay, Patrick, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, for the casual gamer, I don't think it's an issue, right? It's just you find the controller that you like best, that feels best in your hand. You know, in full disclosure, I've done some work with SCUF. I know those guys. They've got a pretty extensive patent portfolio on their controllers. You know, I think it as far as within the tournament in the professional realm, that's really more of a tournament organization kind of thing. I kind of look at it like the same way that there's rules on restrictor plates in auto racing, right? I mean, it's you know, you have to measure and make sure it's a level playing field for the tournament players. And if SCUF's the best one, and you know, then that's going to be available to somebody, that's fine as long as it's within the rules.
Right. Okay, let's move from playing games to watching them, even though we've already discussed the line between the two is blurry. So one big thing that's happened lately is that YouTube has decided it's going to split off its own YouTube gaming platform to more directly compete with Twitch. So there's it's basically its own flavor of YouTube with its own app that is focused on the gaming world. First, I want to ask our panelists what they think about spectator platforms in general, and then we'll talk about some specific legal issues that that might be impacted by some recent law. So, Suzanne, let's start with you. Twitch, YouTube, I know there are others out there. Does it matter? Does there have to be one? Is it good that there are many?
I like competition in the market. I'm a capitalist. So I use YouTube to watch Let's Plays all the time. It's fantastic. I can pull them up. They're recorded. It's wonderful. I also stream development live on Twitch once a week or so. And I have folks that log in and chat with me while I'm streaming live. And I think it's good to have those different options and different ways of viewing things. And I think they're trying to compete with one another, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get rid of one or the other because they're providing different services.
Okay, Patrick, are there differences contractually that YouTubers should know about if they decide to go with one platform over another?
Well, I think there certainly could be. You know, right now it doesn't seem that that's the case, but I think eventually you might see people game companies affiliating themselves or more aligning with one over another, or trying to do it that way. And You know, and then you're going to have really a bit more of a fight. But right now, it's more of a wide open playing field. Whatever works.
Right. And I just caught myself saying YouTuber. If you're a Twitch person, I guess you're not a YouTuber.
Right.
But Twitter. That's becoming kind of a generic term. Ryan, what do you think about the? Go ahead.
Yeah. What's funny about all that is, you know, if YouTube really wanted to compete, they should have done two things. And when I say YouTube, I guess I mean Google. If they wanted to compete, they should have not called it YouTube, and they should have offered a better revenue split than Twitch does. Instead, they kept it YouTube, and they offer, from what I've seen, the same revenue split. When you become a very successful streamer, Twitch, and I'm sure YouTube, offers you a specific contract with you to keep you exclusive and on their channel and everything like that. But here, a lot of viewers and a lot of streamers had so many issues with Twitch because they were doing things like muting music and other copyright issues I'm sure we'll get into in a moment. And they were really looking for an alternative. I mean, I love Twitch. I think Twitch is a great platform, and Twitch is not going anywhere by any means. But they were looking for just another source. The way we have NBC, they were looking for an ABC. And YouTube is possibly the only online streaming service that people had more of an issue with than Twitch. So they should have really rebranded and resold themselves if they wanted to steal any portion of the market. I don't see them doing it long term at all. And they have the content ID systems, which are, you know, shutting down so many of the top streamers long term and for substantial amounts of time that Twitch doesn't have. Twitch is muting videos, or was muting videos instead. You know, I don't see them being anything that's going to really hurt Twitch in the long run. They'll take some of the stream, of course, but that somebody was going to eventually. But they're not going to knock Twitch off top, in my predictions.
Okay, well, those copyright issues do get kind of interesting in the wake of the Lens versus Universal case, which we've talked about for the last couple of weeks on the show, recently out from the Ninth Circuit, which imposes a duty on folks sending takedown notices to consider fair use before they do so. So I'm curious to get your takes on whether that's a big boon for the streamers in the video game industry, or whether the copyright questions that they grapple with might fall outside the fair use parameters and therefore aren't really helped by the Lens case. What do you think, Suzanne?
If I had a nickel for every time someone came up to me and said, "Hey, it's fair use, so I'm fine," before asking a question, I'd be a very wealthy woman. But in any case, this is strictly out of the Ninth. And while there's some argument that it's going to spread a lot and be nationwide at some point in the future, right now, it's an interesting thought. And it's something I think you should consider as a legal person in any case, whether or not there's some legitimate defense that's going to shut down your attempts to take something down. I don't think it's going to make a huge difference in terms of legitimate takedown requests. It may stop some of the trolley behavior where folks go on and just send takedowns because you can't post glitches from one of the games, otherwise they might not sell as many games, but we'll see how it pans out. I'm hopeful.
Right. So, Ryan, you're in the Second Circuit. Do you think the folks, businesses in your jurisdiction will take this Ninth Circuit decision to heart and begin considering fair use before they send out takedown notices, or you think they're going to wait for your court to weigh in?
I know I said earlier lawyers should not speak in absolutes, but I think absolutely across the board in both my circuit and the Ninth Circuit, not a single corporation is going to let this change a single thing they do. I think this decision might as well have not happened. It's a huge victory for the EFF, certainly, but the EFF funded this. So when this woman who has a dancing baby video gets a DMCA takedown, she's not going to sue Universal. She's not going to have the budget for that. Fair use has not changed in any substantial way unless you're a major company. So for my larger clients, sure, I might say, hey, we should really think about butting heads on this one. For the majority of my clients and the majority of game studios and the majority of Let's Players and Twitch streamers and et cetera, they don't have any iota of hope of making this useful for them until this really starts to get recognized industry-wide and across the board as something substantial. The lines, as I read them, and I'm certainly not I haven't read it start to finish in excruciating detail, But the lines between what is a legitimate takedown seem to not have changed much, other than you really need to truly believe it's not fair use. Fair use is such a gray area that you can think it's not fair use. Just because this video with the dancing baby was fair use doesn't mean another video with a dancing couple to a song is also fair use, because that couple might be relying on the song more in that company's eyes or whatever, whatever, whatever. I just don't see this being anything substantial. I do the AMA on Reddit, as you said earlier, and the audience there is usually the kind of penniless to mid-tier developer, and I'm very adamant to tell them over and over again that fair use does not exist in their world. It's a word that they should not have in their vocabulary. It's a word they should never rely on, because you have to prove it in a court, and until a judge says it's fair use, it's not, and they're not going to be able to afford that fight.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good and practical point. Patrick, you're back here in the Ninth Circuit with me. Do you think this impacts the ability of video game streamers to avoid takedown notices or not?
No, I mean, it doesn't. It's not changing. I agree with Ryan. It's not changing anything. Anybody who's sending a takedown notice, we're already considering fair use, right? It's just part of the equation. I really don't think this changes much of anything either.
Okay, what about the larger issues of the kinds of copyright concerns that we see with Let's Play videos? We've talked about music. What we haven't talked about yet on this show, though we've talked about it when I've had you folks on before, is the use of segments of the game that are the bread and butter of Let's Play videos. Any developments there? Any signs that game developers are embracing this officially as a way to give broader exposure to their platforms and get more customers and fans? Or is it all just still up in the air? What do you think, Patrick?
I think it's still up in the air. It depends on the game company and how they view their product and how they want it. Some view it as free marketing and embrace it, and some look at it and say they don't want to see it up there. So and it depends on the game, it depends on the company culture, and sometimes it depends on the content that's being played, right? And they might like some and not others. So it's all across the board in my view.
Suzanne, any thoughts on that?
I'm the same way. It's all over the place. Some game developers don't want you showing anything. Some game developers don't want you showing glitches. But if you give positive reviews, you're not going to get a DMCA takedown notice. And some game developers, you can show anything because any publicity is good publicity for them.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, not to disclose your client confidences, but in your AMAs that are out in public, how do you tell people to approach this?
I'm very quick to tell everyone, don't use IP that's not yours. That includes a soundtrack, that includes streaming a game that you don't own, that you don't see other people also successfully streaming. You know, don't be the one to test the waters unless you want to truly be the one testing the waters. You know, that said, there's a lot of companies that are very open about, hey, please play our game, we're happy to do it. There's also a lot of companies that are very clearly against it. The line usually is, if it's a story-driven game, they don't want people playing their game publicly because it gives away the spoilers, it gives away the plot twists, and I get that. I don't know if you've had T.L. Taylor on the show. She's a wonderful professor at MIT about social issues in esports and gaming, and she had a very nice argument on a panel I was with where she basically said that before anyone had even really known what Let's Play videos are, she's been arguing that Let's Play videos are transformative. And since this is a legal show, I won't get too much into the difference between transformative and derivative. But the idea of a Let's Play video being transformative, I don't know how much I necessarily agree with that in where you're allowed to do whatever you want with the IP you're playing with. It's it's a fine line there. I really don't know where will wind up with that when it does get tested legally. But as of now, it's as Patrick and Suzanne said, you basically just have to see what the company's feelings are and try not to skirt around those.
Right. And thank you for the guest suggestion. We will definitely reach out to Professor Taylor.
Yeah.
Before we leave the realm of copyright-related, content-related issues, Patrick, you suggested that we talk about new participants in the gaming ecosystems, new publishers, new funders, et cetera, and how they're driving a lot of content creation. Can you tell us your thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you see that with I think the rise of mobile and tablet games in general, being an open platform, has spurred that on. A lot of companies now that were used to be sort of work for hire developers that would work through other people are now publishing their own games, right? You look at companies that like Double Fine that are doing some indie publishing of other folks out there as well, and there's some others. And it's because of the open platforms. And then you look at the outside investment that they're able to get, the changing, I don't want to call it diminished, but the changing role of a typical publisher. And sometimes all you need is just the financing for the game, and you don't need all the other services that a publisher used to provide. So finding the money is still not easy, but that's solvable. You look at Kickstarter and now Fig, which are helping to solve that problem, and you're able to create content in a new way. And now what that's done is it's opened things up for other folks that want to be in that space. You look at, obviously it's not new, but you look at Amazon in the game space and what they've been trying to do, which is either fund content themselves directly for their own devices or for other devices as well. You look at VR and Oculus and what they're doing. All of these are new outlets for new compelling content, and all of that's going to breed new publishing partners. So I think that's great. I think from a consumer perspective, because you have all these new opportunities to play new games.
So is there a parallel here then between, you know, sort of the old studio system in Hollywood and indie filmmakers, except even more so maybe here, that you really don't need to be EA or Bungie or Blizzard to get a game out there and get traction, especially given all the new funding avenues that are available. Is that accurate?
I think so. I think even more so. Like you said, the indie films are great, but eventually there's still a funnel from a distribution standpoint if you want them in the theaters, right? And the that's controlled, and less so I think on the independent game side. So you'll see independent games that have an avenue. It may not be a retail version that you can go buy at GameStop for Xbox. But there is still an avenue to see that game, and I think that's incredibly valuable.
Well, Ryan says consoles are dead anyway, right? So,
right.
What do you think, Suzanne? I know you've worked with some indie game developers.
Yeah, there's been a lot of articles going around about what's called the indie game bubble, which is where there's now so many indies producing content, and a lot of it is mediocre or not fantastic content, and releasing it on all of these platforms that are so democratizing, like Steam and mobile. That even if you have a spectacular game, you're not able to get the traction to make you a millionaire or even make a living off of your really spectacular indie game. I don't think I necessarily agree with that yet. I can understand the concerns. And I think the rise of these new platforms like VR can help battle that in a certain way, because we're going to be spreading to these new platforms and there will be fewer games on VR than there are on Steam or mobile. And initially, those games are going to get the attention and they're going to actually win or lose on merits rather than visibility.
Okay. Ryan, do you agree?
Yeah. Truth be told, my computer just locked up, so I missed the last couple sentences there. I apologize. Having terrible
luck. You agree anyway.
Yeah, I'm all on board.
Yeah. All right, good. Let's move on, since we're talking about parallels between the gaming industry and the world of film, TV, and music. Let's talk about the intersection of the two. All right, so I think on one of our two past gaming panel shows, we talked about the Lindsay Lohan case and how she believes there's a representation of her in Grand Theft Auto. That kind of thing, I think, has been on the rise. First of all, do we know anything about any status developments in Lindsay's case? Has there been any outcome there, Patrick?
Not that I'm aware of. I quite honestly, I haven't been paying attention to that one.
Yeah. How about other ones?
I focus on the more collaborative and permissive uses of Hollywood talent in games.
Right. And is that becoming more common?
Yes. I've probably done 8 or 9 film and television properties licensed into games companies in the past year. I think, again, mobile and tablet is something that, that gives a rise naturally to licensed content, because the biggest issue for such a big open platform that like Suzanne was talking about is discoverability and familiarity. So if you're going through the App Store and you want to find something that looks like you want to download it and play, assuming it's free and you've got a million choices to make, you might gravitate towards something that you've known a little bit. So you take what Lionsgate did with the Hunger Games, and in full disclosure, we represented Lionsgate on that license to Kabam, so that they licensed the property out. It was relatively successful. It helped the film property, and it helped Lionsgate formulate their strategy going forward for the rest of their catalog of films. So now they've hired some people to help them, and they're effectively now one of those new entrants that I was talking about. They've got an active presence in the games business, and I think some of the other studios are starting to see that as well. Whereas 5 or 8 years ago, certain properties were just not going to be an option. The traditional licensed game in a box used to be a bad game, right? And it's not necessarily the case anymore.
Right. There, I think traditionally were some that made sense, big, huge, imaginative worlds like Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. I think the game intersection there intuitively makes more sense to people, but maybe not with something like 50 Shades of Grey or, right. Name your movie of choice. Right. But you're seeing more of the not, of course we're going to have a game that goes along with this movie. You're seeing more people think, hey, maybe we should have a game and maybe that'll work.
Absolutely, because now you can be creative as to what kind of game that is. So whereas maybe, I think there was an announcement the other day that I think it was Glue is publishing the next game based on the James Bond movie. Well, maybe that didn't warrant another James Bond, console retail shooter, but they're doing a strategy mobile game for that franchise, and that makes sense. I mean, of course, there should be something out there. VR is the same thing. So I was involved with obtaining the rights for a VR based game on the Paranormal Activity franchise, because horror and it kind of goes with the VR experience a little bit better. So there's a renewed interest and at least a perceived opportunity. Obviously, you have to make a quality content in both cases first, but there's an opportunity there that might not have been there if it was just, okay, we're going to make another game for the PS4, right?
Right. Suzanne, any thoughts on the intersection of Hollywood and gaming?
Yeah, so the Lindsay Lohan decision has not yet come down. We're waiting on bated breath for it. But we did have a decision with Noriega, who is a not nice gentleman out of South America, in Call of Duty. Mm-hmm. And he was basically a dictator and drug lord, and they cast him as a dictator and drug lord under his actual name in the game. So he sued the game because he did not at all license the use of his name or image in that particular way. And the court basically threw it out because they were like, you're in prison. We're not going to pay you a licensing fee to profit off of having been a terrible human being. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in terms of these unlicensed uses. And of course, anyone who comes and says, hey, I want to make a game containing this person, the first thing you say is, well, have you asked them? And the answer is typically no, but sometimes yes. And when it's yes, we're hopeful. And when it's no, you can ask. There's no harm in asking. Even if you're completely broke and can't call a lawyer, there are studio email addresses. There are personal email addresses. You have Google. Find someone, email them, be like, hey, so is this okay, before you have to spend tons of money apologizing and learning out that you're not making money off of your criminal acts.
Right. I didn't read the decision against Manuel Noriega. Did you get the impression that it would have been a different outcome if he had not been a notorious international drug lord?
It was just hilarious, someone who, honestly. Yeah. I feel like it would have been a lot more sympathetic had he not been so notorious. I think a lot of it was given the nature of what he was claiming that he was trying to profit off of. It was just unacceptable for the court to be like, yeah, you can totally make millions of dollars off that while sitting in prison. That's cool.
Right.
And that was a fun scenario too, because After the papers were filed, I think Activision brought in co-counsel on that, and they brought in Rudy Giuliani as their co-counsel, which I thought was pretty cool. So again, it was, you know, apart from the merits, it was just a fun train wreck to watch.
Yeah.
With the Lindsay Lohan case, I'm pretty sure I saw on Reddit of all places that the model that they used came forward who looked exactly like that woman in the picture, and it was just not what Lindsay Lohan thought. It was a case of just bloated ego, but who knows? Those things are always interesting.
I saw a photo of Lindsay Lohan recently on Fashion Police, you know, the Melissa Rivers show that carries on in the wake of Joan Rivers, where she was just exactly like she was about to make an appearance in Grand Theft Auto. So I'm not sure what message she's trying to send.
The ironic thing is I don't think Lindsay Lohan looks like Lindsay Lohan anymore. So, you know, it's so who's to say what she even looks like? Yeah. She's changed so much over the years.
Yes. Yeah, it's a fun story there regardless. It's almost Rudy Giuliani level good. Yeah. but yeah, I mean, to what Patrick said too, the movie and TV studios are starting to realize that not only are games potentially profitable, but yeah, they don't have to make bad games for their movies and TV shows. Some shows have started making apps that you play while you're watching their show. So you are literally, you know, feeling like you're playing part along with the show. You're voting on things or making things happen. Right. So they're really embracing both worlds. And, you know, we have Vin Diesel to thank for that. Vin Diesel was the first actor who made Chronicles of Riddick, and they were making a game for it. He spent half the money up from the movie to buy the rights to the video game and made the game himself, produced it, did all the voice work, and made an awesome game that is still playable and awesome today. And ever since then, we've seen more successful movie games. So thank you, Vin Diesel.
And that game was... one of the big things about that game was that it didn't just sort of follow the movie script, because there was a departure. It was sort of a side story based on that same universe. And I was working for the publisher who made that game at the time, and that was unique at the time. Most of the games then were, you know, see the movie, play the movie, right? And mm-hmm. you would go through the exact same scenes and whatnot. And that game, you know, the Escape from Butcher Bay was very unique at the time, and I think all the mobile games are moving in that direction, because the ongoing nature of the mobile and the tablet games leads it to you can't follow the movie because the game's going to have more content than the movie. So I think that's perpetuating the fact that good games can happen on mobile platforms based on licenses.
Well, thank you for bringing up Vin Diesel, because I wanted to ask Patrick, we were talking before about how esports players need a union. Actors have one, probably arguably several. How is SAG-AFTRA reacting to the intersection between video games and Hollywood properties?
They are right now renegotiating a deal for the voiceover talent in games. And there's a handful of signatories on the game side that have agreed years ago to basic rules and regulations, collectively bargained with union talent for voiceover work. And SAG-AFTRA wants to renegotiate, and they're seeing that games are making more money, and they're looking at this as an opportunity to have their members make more money. So they are threatening right now to strike for some better terms. The terms are not a ridiculous departure from where they were. The union is trying to take baby steps on that, but the rest of the signatories are kind of taking the position of we don't feel that we need to better the deal that you have in front of you, because games don't necessarily sell based on the voiceover talent that's in them, except for maybe rare few exceptions, you know, like a Vin Diesel and you know, or the star talent that, you know, that's based on a movie property. So that's ongoing, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. And if a strike does occur, how the question is going to be how much that even impacts the industry, because I've read numbers that say 80% of voiceover work in games is done through non-union talent anyway. So this would only affect a certain type of game through a certain type of company.
Yeah,
got it.
Go ahead. Miles behind from my own experience, I there was also a lot of headlines about kind of Austin Wintory, who's a very famous and successful game composer, going against the American Federation of Musicians, which is a union for composers of the like, because mm-hmm. they had no clauses written for the game studio work he was doing. He was forced to use some non-union members for some of the tracks, and I represented him in that, so I'll stop speaking about it. Not that it's anything confidential, but just mm-hmm. how ridiculous a lot of it turned out to be. And what Austin went through was very unfortunate, and just a sign that these unions are so used to the entertainment industry being A, B, and C, and games are such a distant D that they don't consider them. They certainly weren't considered when they were doing the previous agreements. And it's always been, oh, those are video games, those are for kids, it's a fad, et cetera, et cetera. Now they're starting to take seriously how much money they're making and how many of these, you know, Kevin Spacey is doing additional voices in Call of Duty. It's something that they just have to take seriously now. And it's just going to get worse before it gets better, as do all these negotiations. But it's very inevitable just with the growth, how quickly games have grown and how archaic a lot of terms are with a lot of unions.
Right. And it does seem, you know, our whole theme of the show today has been how this is a juggernaut, no pun intended, that is not going to slow down, but is going to continue to expand and be an economic force in the world. So although a lot of the voiceover work might be done by non-union folks now, that seems like it would change in the future as more and more folks would want to have this kind of work and think it's a great opportunity. I promised Suzanne that we would talk about the obliteration of the human race before the end of the show. We will certainly do that. We need a second MCLE passphrase, so let's make it Lindsay Lohan GTA, or Lohan. I never know how to say her name, but one of the two will work for our MCLE passphrase purposes. We're also going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is perfect because in my neck of the woods, it's lunchtime. And if you're looking for a delicious lunch or dinner, you should definitely be thinking about Blue Apron, because we all love to eat, but it's hard to find a meal that doesn't compromise somewhere. You want it to be a good value. You want it to be quick to prepare. You want it to be healthy and delicious. Well, Blue Apron gives you all of that. Blue Apron makes cooking delicious meals easy and fun by delivering fresh, ready-to-cook meals right to your door. And for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron sends you fresh ingredients, perfectly proportioned, with step-by-step recipe instructions, including beautifully printed pictures that you can save and use later if you want to reproduce that dish. It's got all the ingredients, everything you need for your shopping list. If you have decided, oh, this is now definitely in my repertoire, and I'm going to make it again. I have a whole drawer of these things now, and it really has replaced my consulting with cookbooks. So you're going to make cooking healthy meals really, really easy and fun if you subscribe to Blue Apron. In fact, if you don't love going to the grocery store, it's the perfect thing for you because it arrives straight at your house and you don't wind up wasting, you know, a whole head of lettuce that you're not going to use. You buy 6 tomatoes and only use 2 and the rest of them become a science project in the fridge. All of that is avoided with Blue Apron, and it's perfect for the more romantic side of your life. If you'd like to cook for that special someone, it makes just a great presentation and impression. It's great for cooking with friends. It's great for cooking with your family, great for introducing kids to the kitchen. And actually, the meals are so delicious that my 11-year-old, who can be something of a picky eater, looks forward to the Blue Apron deliveries and says, "Ooh, what are we going to make this time?" Definitely the whole family can eat well and have fun preparing the meals together. And you can feel good about serving them to your family and friends because each balanced meal is 500 to 700 calories per serving. So yummy, you'd never know that. Cooking takes about half an hour, you know, give or take. Maybe give yourself 45 minutes if you're not, you know, the world's greatest chopper. Shipping is free and the menus are always new. They won't send the same meal twice. They work around your schedule and your dietary preferences, and Blue Apron's experts source only the best seasonal ingredients for incredible meals like seared chicken and caramelized minced fennel with creme fraiche and roasted cherry tomatoes, or mixed mushroom tacos and crispy avocado and cotija cheese. And although you might think about Blue Apron for great meals, you should also think about them for wine delivery now. They've offered this great parallel complement to their meal deliveries, that if you want some good wine pairings that are matched with the things that are on your menu, and you, again, don't like hanging out in the grocery store or the liquor store, they're actually doing a wine delivery service now too, which is really cool. You'll cook incredible meals and be blown away by the quality and freshness, if you want to invite your freshman friends over too. I'm sure they'll enjoy it. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right, two meals for free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for the delicious food and your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about global destruction on the biological scale. The most strange educational game I've ever seen. So, Suzanne, when I think about educational games, I think about a lot of things. Plague Inc. would not be the first one that comes to mind, but having watched it played through now several times, there are, and what this involves, if you've never seen the game, I guess it's been around for like a year or so. It seems like it's really on an uptick in popularity right now, much like one of its pestilences spreading all over the globe. But there actually is some legitimate information there, both geographically and biologically, about pathogens. I understand you're a big fan. Can you tell us more about Plague Inc.?
Yeah, can we first of all mention how weird it is to be split between that bumper and a game about murdering all of humanity?
Yes, let's mention that because, again, you know, I think that this game is not the first thing that comes to mind when I think about educational games, but maybe it is the future of educational games because it certainly seems to keep kids' attention. It's rated 12 plus, at least in the iTunes store.
I can see that. There's no actual violence that you see. You get to hear about all the symptoms you're creating, but you don't actually see any of them. And they're not too graphic about any of it either. It's a really interesting game because you get to work with genetics and evolve your plague to different levels of severity. You get to work with how airlines connect different countries, how boats connect different countries, what animals transfer across different land masses, how food impacts that, and government shutdowns and funding and how those relate back to disease control. It's a great exploration of the interlocking systems within disease management, both on like the evil level of us creating diseases and on the level of the world fighting against those diseases. And it actually links back to the licensing we were talking about earlier, because they've added add-ins like Planet of the Apes, where you got to play as a disease that made apes intelligent and then control your ape uprising, which has little to do with the movie, but relates back in a great licensing way.
Yeah, it sure does. I was unaware of that part. Usually I sort of am dumbfounded watching this game being played in front of me as humanity is dying continent by continent, and wondering if I'm not just witnessing a little version of Ender's Game right here, where this is perhaps... The players do not know that they are playing something out in reality. It's quite terrifying.
I've definitely played it at airports and on the train and at the train station, and had some older folks looking over my shoulder as the entire map is slowly turning black, red and then black as I'm killing off all of humanity. I'm surprised I haven't had anyone called to check up on what exactly it is I'm doing when I'm playing this game.
Yes, exactly. Well, and that the fact that you play it in airports is somewhat appropriate, right? Because isn't that one of the main ways you can transmit a disease?
It's one of the first ones I always genetically upgrade. I antibiotic resistance and then transport through air and water, because you got to get to Greenland, man. If you don't get to Greenland, you're never going to win.
Yeah, what's up with Greenland and Iceland? They're pretty hard to
They only have water intake, and as soon as something goes national, they shut their borders, so you can't get in there with birds or small creatures, and it...
Right. Understanding, is that accurate? Are they more preserved from the spread of global pathogens than some of the rest of us?
More reserved politically, so... Mm-hmm. From that side, it makes sense, and it gives you a sense of culturally where things are spreading. For example, lower economic countries tend to have more disease spread from things like blood-to-blood contact than higher economic stance countries, just based on how things work in the real world. So there are a lot of really subtle messages going on as well.
Right. So, Ryan, what do you think of this? I don't know if you pay much attention to educational games or the world of developing educational games, but it seems like there's something really telling going on in this game, that there are some things to be learned here. It's somewhat horrifying to think of 12 and 13-year-olds pretending that they are obliterating mankind, whether it's with a disease or the intelligent apes they have developed. But... also, I do see that it's a game that conveys a lot of information. It's a game that keeps kids engaged. And, you know, I've seen schools try to use games in the classroom, math games, for example, and they're just dry and boring, and the kids can't wait to get out of there. What I see with this one is the kids can't wait to play it. Does that tell you anything about the future of educational games?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels to what Patrick was saying earlier about movie games. It used to be, educational games used to be games about education that were for education and made just to teach and not games. Now this is a game that also accidentally teaches you some things. Mm-hmm. Even when it's not directly teaching you something in this game, it's making you think. It's really exercising your brain muscles. It's absolutely better than, you know, sitting and staring and playing a game like Candy Crush. And it's something that has a lot of potential for how students are going to be learning in the future. I'm not saying teachers are going to be removed and the courses are going to disappear, but the way kids are taught is absolutely going to change as we progress. It's just inevitable. That's happened in every technological advance throughout history. So the next step here is, European history class, we played a game called Europa Universalis, which is a strategy game akin to this, but you're playing an old king instead of a disease, but your goal is still to take over Europe and things like that. But you, mm-hmm. you know, I know the 1583 map of Europe better than anyone because of that game. And it really has taught me a lot about history and about how different empires formed and fell, because it's all based on real information, real facts, real people, which makes it incredibly interesting. A game like Plague here, it's teaching kids where everything is in the world. Now, mm-hmm. I would bet most 12-year-olds don't know where Madagascar is. Now you play this game, all of a sudden you know where Madagascar is because it's a hard one to get and it's in your head. It teaches you different strategy about budgeting resources and spending things on this disease before you do this. There's a lot of real valuable skills that are taught in games like this, and that's where gamification of education is going to go, I think.
Yep, I think I'm with you there. Patrick, you wanted to talk about VR. This game seems like a good context to bring it up in because it's such a simple interface. It's really just a global map. So it's maybe an argument that VR is not going to bolt on to every single game out there or be a good fit with every single game out there, but I think that you think that there are lots of opportunities for VR in the gaming industry right now.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the dynamics of anything creative is that there's going to be some things that are more suited for a certain type of exploitation and some that are not. I mean, I think you can't put all games in the same category. And I was actually having this chain on the message board. You know, not mm-hmm. every game is it can be grouped with painted with the same brush in the same way you can't paint movies with the same brush. There are certain kinds of movies that that you want to go see with your kids, and there's certain kind of movies you want to go see by yourself, right? And books is the same thing, comic books, and I look at this the same way. This is a very well thought out creative game. It just might not be suited for, you know, it might not be suited for the Nintendo DS, and it might not be suited for VR, right? It's found its niche, and that's great.
Wonderful. Anything final you want to say about Plague, Suzanne, before we get to our tip and resource of the week?
If you see someone playing it, don't report them for anything because it's a legitimate learning tool. It's great to see educational games going somewhere. I mean, I still play the educational games I played as a kid. I have Zoom Beanies and Math Blaster and Spelling Jungle on my computer, so maybe I'm a bit nerdier than everyone else, but this game really seems to be taking off.
It sure does. All right, our tip of the week is something that I hope that we've gotten across to you already without my even having to specifically make it a tip, but I'm going to do that anyway, just in case. It is lawyer up when signing up. Ross Hirschman has one of the articles in our discussion points today. He's been on the show with us before on one of our prior gaming panels, and he has this to say about competitive gamers and folks who aspire to be one. The majority of competitive gamers are on the younger side and very eager to play games for a living. The exciting prospect of going pro sometimes clouds their judgment, and they enter into one-sided contracts that actually exploit them. If you are a competitive gamer, it is best to have any contract you are considering reviewed by an attorney before you sign it. Not just reviewed, but I would say taken apart and spit out, cut up, and sent back in the way that makes most sense for you as the gamer, and have a negotiation and a dialogue, even if that means that you're going to not be able to play for a particular team, because if they're not going to negotiate your agreement, I don't think it's a team you want to be on. Anything to add to that, Ryan?
Yeah, actually just that last point where I have negotiated a lot of esports players agreements and a lot of just even game developers with publisher agreements, whatever kind of game industry contract, where that's a fear, what you just ended with, where they think if we negotiate this, the deal's going to fall through. I want to play for this team. I want to work for this publisher or put my game with this publisher. But I'm so afraid to go back with Redlines because they're going to say no and just kick me out and get someone else. That's that's not been the case once in my experience. Every single time I've negotiated an agreement, we've come to a consensus and move forward. Not once has a deal been something we had to walk away from. Because once it gets to that point, people are willing to negotiate. They're not picking you out of thin air. They're not picking your game out of thin air or your skill set out of thin air. They want you, and they want your skills, and you should really take that seriously and have someone advocate for your rights before you sign on to something long-term or even short-term.
Right, and I guess the footnote to this discussion is I think sometimes young people don't necessarily look at the world in a distrustful way and might think that, oh, you know, this is such a great opportunity. These people love me. They would never do anything bad to me. And that you need to be a little bit more cynical in your approach to business dealings, because as much as they may love you, they still may put an agreement in front of you and have you or your parents sign it that disadvantages you in various ways. And that's just unfortunately how business works sometime. Anything to add to that, Patrick?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I've had plenty of clients over the years who've come to me and said, "Here's the deal. I'm going to sign it in an hour, whether you like it or not. So, but take a look at it, right? Okay, I'm happy to do that and point out where things go wrong or might go wrong. But you know, you're not really setting yourself up for the best case scenario. And unfortunately, our job as lawyers is to think about what could go wrong and think about that worst case scenario and plan against it. There's a fine line between the two, and pushing back in the right fashion, in the right forum, and with the right level of tact and etiquette, you can get movement on a lot of these things, right? There is no such thing as a take it or leave it deal, with very few exceptions. And you just have to understand what's important and present it in the right way.
Right. Okay, we have a good resource of the week for you, too. This is published over at JD Supra's Business Advisor site, and it is 5 legal issues your esports company needs to know about operating in the United States. Some great things to think about, many of which we've talked about on the show today. Not just in drafting contracts with the people who are going to be playing for you, but the terms and conditions for your other users, what privacy laws you need to consider, The whole question of COPPA, which we haven't mentioned once today, but since many games are going to involve people under the age of 13, there's a whole compliance layer there that you need to consider if you're in that space. So definitely check out this article for the five legal issues. You know, there are many more, but these five at least should be on your radar if you're thinking about going into the world of esports, not from the competitor side, but from the business side. And I can't think of a better panel to discuss all these issues and help you understand both the competitor and business side of video gaming these days. Suzanne Jacque, I'm so excited that you are almost officially a practicing lawyer. It's really wonderful to chat with you again. Anything going on other than your good news that you want to share with us before we get on out of here?
Nothing too interesting right now, just trying to hang in there for the next month and get everything sorted out and on the right track.
Yes, and we appreciate you hanging in there with us for the show, and we are glad that you get to go and get some rest now and enjoy your weekend and go. It's a good time in your life. Ryan Morrison, great to see you again.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure as always.
Other than finding you on Reddit and slavishly following your AMAs, anything else you want to leave folks with?
No, just that, you know, Patrick, myself, and all the other game attorneys around out there, we're not a bunch of evil monsters. We actually are looking out for you. So don't be afraid to call us and just ask a question or two. It's the industry is not as scary as it seems on a legal side.
Yes. Even though you might have some avatars in which you look like an evil monster.
Right.
Simply for playing purposes.
Right.
All right, Patrick, great seeing you. Wonderful chatting with you today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, is there anything going on with your firm or your practice that you'd like to share with folks?
Nothing other than hopefully expanding and adding Suzanne to the role full time. So we're working on that. And other than that, you know, home stretch of the year, got a lot of fun things in the hopper for some of our clients that will be announced soon. So that's worth paying attention to.
It is. See, folks, they're negotiating. It's a good thing. Bear it in mind. All right, this has been This Week in Law. If you have joined us on a Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. That means you've joined us while we recorded the show live. We're glad that you did, if you could. If you can't do that, don't worry about it. Go find our show page at twit.tv/twill. That's where our whole archive of shows is, plus any number of ways that you can watch the show on your own time, on your own device, on your own TV on the wall, or phone in your hand, however you like to enjoy the show, whether it's at the gym or nighttime after your luscious Blue Apron dinner, whatever is your preference. We're there for you whenever, wherever you would like to find us. My co-host Sarah was out this week, but she'll be back next week. So don't worry. She will join us again soon. And we will see you next Friday here on This Week in Law. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care.